I just wanted to say a big hello and to tell you how grateful I am to be here. You don't know how many years I've looked forward to seeing this museum. And here I am, a dream fulfilled. As I was captured by the Japanese, what do you think the very first word I learned in Japanese was?
Ohio.
Exactly. I knew somebody spoke Japanese tonight, and what does that word mean? Well, when they picked me up, this officer walked in and just said, Ohio, and I said, no, California. And another officer came in, and he says Ohio, but it should be Ohio Gozaimasu. That means good morning. So that was my first Japanese word, was Ohio. Now tonight I'm going to tell you things I've never talked about before, because I never talk about the combat missions and some of the hilarious things we did prior to combat, but I'll go into that, and I hope the interpreter can pick it up. But 76 years now of life in 1 hour, and I hope they'll lock the doors so no one will leave. I was actually, even though people think I'm a native California, I was born in Upper New York, Olean. And my brother and I both had a severe case of pneumonia that didn't seem to go away, and the doctor said to my mother, take your boys to California, or they'll probably both die. So we came to California, and both of us became runners, of all things. We moved to Long Beach. The house burnt down. My dad grabbed my brother and I and rushed out on the front lawn. And my mother turned around and said, where's Louie? My dad said, well, right there. And it was a pillow. He brought my brother out in a pillow. He had to go back in the burning house, and he fumbled around in the smoke and found me under the bed. He finally got me to the front porch when it collapsed, and, of course, he got burnt pretty badly in the legs. And 6 months later in Long Beach also, I was playing with a kid on the street, and he challenged me to a race down to the corner intersection. He beat me. I was a lousy runner. Thank goodness, because he was hit by a car and mangled. Then we moved to Torrance. That's my hometown. That's where the airfield is. It was a P-38 base during the war, and it was actually named as Zamperini Field when I was declared dead. And so naturally, when I came home, the city dads were quite disappointed. And believe me, it's been a hassle ever since 1946. And the climax of the naming of the airfield will come into fruition this April, after all those years. That is, it'll be legally named Zamperini Field, Zamperini Tower, coming out of the FAA in Washington, D.C. Well, Torrance, I call that my hometown, small town of 2,500 people. Nick Apple, operations officer here, was raised in San Pedro, just across the hills from me. Between San Pedro and Torrance, a forest of oil wells. I mean a forest. That's all there were oil wells, and that was our playground. We climbed oil wells. And I was climbing up an oil well, and the step broke loose. I fell backwards on a tin shack, rolled over into a thump hole. And I knew that was it. You can't swim in oil, and I was sinking, and I straddled a pipe. And somehow I managed to work myself up to the surface, and I was just pitch black from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I had to walk about a mile home. I came down Gramercy Street, walking down the middle of the street, you know, like a mummy. People came out on their porches, staring in curiosity, and I saw my mother come out, and when I stopped in front of the house and faced her, she looked puzzled, then she just said, Louie? My dad had just got home from work, he came out, and all he had was turpentine. Now, you men probably know what turpentine does when you put it on your skin, and then you're dipped in hot water. And so I looked like a red turnip when my father got through with me, but that taught me a good lesson, never to go back to the oil fields again. Now, from that time up to the age of 15, I was in constant conflict with the Torrance police. I always seemed to be in trouble. My brother was one of those good boys, good grades in school. So he went to the principal of the school. He called the chief of police. They got their heads together and says, well, you know, sports might be the answer to Louis's problem. So they stuck me in a race called a 660-yard run in the interclass track meet. And I came in last, of course. But what I suffered was the pains of exhaustion, and I didn't like that, and it was brutal. That was the worst suffering I ever had in my life. And I thought, this is my first and last race. They'll never get me on the track again. Well, a week later, our first big dual meet, Narbonne High School, and my brother was on me again. So he finally got me out on the track, and this time they had three runners, and I was the only runner from Torrance. Coming down the home stretch, I was in fourth place, and just before I hit the tape, I actually passed the fellow in third place. And as I did, I kept hearing the students from my high school hollering, come on, Louie. Well, boy, this was sweet, because I didn't even know anyone knew my name. And here they were calling me, come on, Louie, come on. So I passed this guy. It was like winning a gold medal in the Olympics. And that tasted pretty good. And that night when I went to bed, I thought about the pains of exhaustion. And I say that sincerely, because I was smoking pretty heavily at that time. I started smoking when I was 5. And picking up cigarette butts on the way to kindergarten. We had a policeman named Bill Malin, motorcycle cop, and he knew this. So he used to try to time his morning by coming by my house when I left for school, and he would put me on the back of the bike and take me to school so I wouldn't be picking up these smoking butts on the side of the road. So I really suffered, and I thought about that. Then I also thought about recognition. The first recognition I ever got in my life was coming in third. And before I went to sleep, I made up my mind. I was going to try to be a runner. And the next day I told my brother, and then I became just as fanatic a trainer as I was a dissipator, and of course that's probably what made me a good runner. I won a race, and I lost a race, and won another race, and I began to set my goals now, determined to be a runner. I wanted to break the world high school record in the mile. I wanted to break the national collegiate record for a very emotional reason, which I'll explain later. And then I wanted to make the 1940 Tokyo Olympics. Now, you notice I skipped the 36 Olympics. I felt I was too young and inexperienced to make the 36 Olympics as a high school boy. I trained for the mile, but there were 5 great collegiate milers and graduates in the nation that were phenomenal, so there was no chance in the mile. I read in the paper about the second best 5,000-meter runner coming to L.A., and I had 2 weeks to train for this race. I'd never run the 5,000 meters. My brother was going into coaching, and he said, well, Louis, there are a lot of laps in 5,000 meters. That's 3 miles, 188 yards. So I'll count the laps, and I'll let you know when the last lap comes so you can move out and do the best you can. Well, he miscounted the laps himself, and he had me go out the last 2 laps. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. I went out, and this fellow passed me. He didn't want me in front. I didn't want him in front, and he passed me again. And I came around to the quarter, and the race wasn't over, and I had another quarter to go, and I tried to take the lead, and he tried to take the lead, and the officials were going crazy on the track, and the grandstand was going crazy. And the last 110 yards, I finally passed him, started pulling away, and we were lapping a fellow from Nick Appletown, San Pedro. He didn't get off the track. He was on lane number 1, and the officials were so excited about the race, which they didn't expect, that they forgot to motion him to get off the track, which is the inside, 1 step and you're off. And the last minute, they motioned him off this way as I was trying to pass him. And so I kept trying to pass him with my momentum. And we finally collided. I went down, hit the ground with my hand, got up. My opponent now was heading for the tape, and I had to catch him again. And got to the tape, he beat me an inch. But that's not important. The important thing was that on the strength of that performance, I was invited to go back to Randolph Island, New York for the Olympic tryouts. And my dad worked for the Big Red Cars, Southern Pacific, and so I had one pass a year anywhere in America. So I had my ticket. And then the merchants of Torrance got me a case and shaving gear and clothing, everything, and sent me off with a big celebration to the Olympic tryouts. And now I'm to run against the world record holder in the 2 mile in New York, and I knew I couldn't beat him. Now, I want to say one thing. I never had very, very much confidence in myself. I always had a lack of self-esteem. But I'm a great believer in whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And I always felt defeated before the race started. But a strange thing happened after the gun went off. That's when I felt really cocky and confident. Now, I knew I couldn't beat this fellow Don Lash. I thought, well, I got to get in the first 3 places to make the Olympics. So I was determined to be second or third. The last lap, it was just Don Lash and I in front. I looked back, and the next fellow was 40 yards behind. So I stuck with Don till the last 220, and I thought, now I'll pass him. Well, I started my pass too late, and he was too smart, kept me on the outside lane, and we ran neck and neck the whole last 220, and we came down hitting the tape in a dead heat. I was an unknown, so they called me the dark horse. And then I ran into the shower, and they had to come in and get me to bring me out to award me my tie with Don Lash and announce that I was now a member of the United States Olympic team. Well, believe me, this is a thrill that is unsurpassed. You've heard gold medalists talk about winning the gold medal. What was the greatest thrill of your life? They don't mention the gold medal. They mention making the team. You have to make the team first. And that's the thrill, making the Olympic team. And now I was part of the group and aboard ship crossing the Atlantic on the SS Manhattan. I was thrilled to death because here I was with all of my sports heroes. I'd looked up to Glenn Cunningham and Gene Venske and swimmers that Eleanor Holmes, remember Eleanor Holmes, Jarrett, got thrown off the team. The greatest backstroke swimmer in the world. She went up the first class with Hirsch, the newspaper's son, and danced with him and had a glass of champagne. And for that, she was thrown off the team by Avery Brundage, the head of the Olympic Committee. Today, that's nothing. They probably give him another medal. But anyway, Hirsch then hired her as a correspondent for the Olympics, which was good for her. Kept her overseas. She got to watch the Olympics, and she did a good job of reporting. I'm now in the 5,000 meter. I have to qualify, so you have to run a trial. I couldn't believe it. A trial run in a 5,000 meter. So I qualified, and I got in the finals. And I'd gained 14 pounds on the boat going over. This is my first trip. First trip away from home. And you know how boats are. The food, I never thought so much food in my life. And I was eating and eating and eating. And then at nighttime, I'd eat again around 9 o'clock and then go to bed. I couldn't lose that weight in time for the Olympics, and so when the race started, I had a hard time keeping pace with the great Finn runners. And so they were out in front, and so we ended up in 3 groups. They were out there 50 yards ahead of the second group. I was in the second group, 7 or 8 of us, and there's a group behind us, 7 or 8. And then the last lap came, and I looked ahead, and those fellows were 50 yards ahead. So I left this group, and I caught the first group. And in doing that, I ran the last lap of the 5,000 meters in 56 seconds flat. And I don't think I ever ran a quarter in 56 seconds flat. But it was timed by 2 officials, and it was written up in the Olympic magazine. But anyway, so I took my shower, came out, got in the stands with the American athletes in their section. Next to us is the buffer zone of officers. Next to them is the cement box where Hitler was. And, of course, we had our cameras. And if you wanted Hitler's picture, you couldn't just walk across the buffer zone. You had to give your camera to one of the officers, and they would take the picture for you. So I gave my camera to an officer, and it happened to be Goebbels, the skinny one. So, is that right? Goebbels was the skinny one. So he said, well, what's your name? I said, why? He said, Hitler wants to know the names of every athlete that takes his picture. I said, well, I didn't win anything. He wouldn't know me anyway. But he said, what's your name? I gave him my name. He came back and said, Hitler wants to meet you. So I went over there, and he reached down and with a flimsy handshake, and he just said, the boy with the fast finish. Didn't win a thing, but got more recognition than the winner of the race. So now I'm free to do what I want. I can dissipate, so I decided to try all the German beers. They had automats. The beers were lined up, and the names of each beer, so we tried as many as we could by the day. Maybe we could go through maybe three or four beers, because they came in a liter. And I had, I think, three beers, and we were walking the streets of Berlin, and I saw a limousine pull up to this building, and I saw Hitler get out. I had just met the guy. And an officer. And there were three officers in the back seat. They went into this building. I guess it was called the Reichschancellery. And I just stood there watching this, and as I started to turn away, I saw this flag on the front wall. Well, one thing that the athletes did was collect souvenirs. We always collected souvenirs wherever we went. We picked up things to bring home. And I thought, well, what better souvenir could I have than Hitler's own swastika from his chancellery? Two guards were marching back and forth on the front walk. And so I stood across the street, and I had my stopwatch, and I would time them as they saluted, turned about, and goose-stepped to the corner. So with their backs to me, I figured I had plenty of time to get across the street, get on the wall, grab the flag, and be away before they reached the corner and turned around. Well, I got on the wall, but the flag was higher than I had judged, and I couldn't reach it. As I tried to reach it, the guards, of course, reached the corner. They turned about, and when they saw me, they began to scream and shout in German, and I had no idea what they were saying. But I knew it wasn't very good, so I was still determined to have that flag. I jumped up, just barely clutched the flag in my fist, and it ripped from the pole as I fell about, 10 feet to the pavement below, and I was, of course, momentarily stunned as I hit the pavement. And then I started to do the thing I did best. And then I heard voices, Haltensee, Haltensee. Well, I didn't need an interpreter to tell me what that meant. And I heard a shot, which was fired in the air, evidently, to get my attention. And then I probably did the smartest thing in my life. I stopped. I had my Olympic suit on. The guard spun me around. And when he saw my Olympic clothes, he knew I was an American athlete. Then he thought that I was one of the Jewish athletes, there were Stoller, Glickman, and Levine, thinking perhaps I tore down the flag for some, reason, anti-Semitic reason. And he asked me my name, and I told him, Zamperini. And he said, why did you tear down the swastika? And I said, I just wanted the flag as a souvenir to take home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had here in your country. Evidently, that was the correct answer. He went inside. Went inside and talked to somebody. He came out, and I heard him say something Fritz. So I imagine that the other officer with Hitler was General von Fritz. If you recall, he opposed the Hitler's regime, I said, somewhat, and was executed. That's what I understand from the papers. So he presented me the flag. He said, I give you this flag to remind you of this something like stupid or experience or hair-raising experience, something like that. So I got the flag, and I still have it. And so after the Olympic Games were over, I came back and entered USC as a freshman and went for my national collegiate mile record. Now, the reason I had to have that record is because my hero when I started running was Glenn Cunningham. Now, this is years back, so a lot of you probably don't remember Glenn Cunningham, but he was the boy, a farm boy that was burnt in a barn fire. His legs were severely burnt, clear up the middle of his back. And the doctor said, you'll never walk again. He not only walked again, but he was 7 miles from school, and he ran to school every day and developed himself into the king of the milers, as they called him. So naturally, he was my hero. I patterned my life after him. And I happened to be in the Coliseum and the National Collegiate meet when Bill Bonfron of Princeton beat my hero Glenn Cunningham in the mile and broke the National Collegiate record. And I turned to my brother and I said, someday I'm going to get that record back for Glenn and me. Now, of course, I'd never met Glenn. But when I went to Minneapolis and ran that race, I broke that record. And you can imagine what a great thrill that was for me to get the record. Of course, now I explained it to Glenn Cunningham. I said, we got the record back. So I felt a great part of him because he was my hero. 1940, the Tokyo Olympics are approaching. War started in Europe in 39. And I'm training like mad for the Olympics. I'm now in my prime, the right age. And the Olympics are canceled. And boy, my heart just sank down so far. I was so depressed. So I immediately got a job at Lockheed and worked on the P-38 and then enlisted in the Air Force and ended up in B-24s, called many names. Some of the milder names was the Flying Coffin, the Flying Boxcars, the Death Trap, and so forth. And, of course, with those kind of rumors floating around, we were, again, I was depressed to get in a plane like that. But somehow you fall in love with the airplane because when it should fly, it couldn't fly. When it shouldn't fly, it does fly. In other words, it took an awful beating in combat and came back alive. Other times, they just fell apart over the Hawaiian Islands. Or blew up from a leaky transfer gas pump, things like that. So now I'm in Hawaii. That's headquarters for the 11th Bomb Group. And we're being trained now for missions. We had no idea where the missions were. There was no enemy around to bomb. Enemies were thousands of miles away, but they kept us there in Hawaii. We trained on skip bombing. Can you believe it? With a four-engine bomber. The bombs would bounce up and hit the plane, so they decided that wasn't the good thing to do. So they decided to try us on dive bombing with a 59-cent sight. We took the $250,000 Norden bomb sight out and put in a 59-cent sight that you hold in your hand. So we're waiting for our first combat mission. So what do you do when you're waiting for a mission? Well, they send you out on search missions every day. You go out and you fan the island looking for enemy submarines. And 99 missions out of 100, you see nothing. And then one day we flew out and we saw a submarine. Oh. But I had 100% in Japanese airplanes and Navy ships. And I knew immediately it was an American submarine. So I got my book out and rechecked it. Sure enough, American submarine. So I gave them the code for that day with the strobe light. No answer. They're supposed to send an answer back. I gave them the code light again. They didn't send the answer back. So the pilot says, what do you want to do? I says, get on course and come into the aft end. I want to open up the bomb bay doors. So he came in on the aft end of the sub, and they're going away from us. And the minute I opened the bomb bay doors, man, they disappeared. So I hope that taught them a lesson. Because if I hadn't known my submarine identification as well as I did, I would have bombed that submarine, and that would have been too bad. Coming back from that mission, we finally got our first assignment. We were given sealed orders, and we were given an open order to take off and fly at a heading of 270 degrees for 15 minutes and then open the seal orders. We opened the seal orders, but we had no bombs. We had no ammunition aboard the ship. We opened the seal orders, and the heading was Midway. So we flew to Midway Island, puzzled. We landed, and four of the Marines were out there like you know, the audience at a football game, cheering and yelling. And so what's going on? Oh, you guys are going to bomb Wake Island at midnight tonight. So that was the first news we had of what our mission was. They immediately blackened the bottom of the plane and got our bomb loads on, and we had Bombay tanks. But even with Bombay tanks, that's half of the Bombay is gas. Nearly we could carry 12 500-pound bombs. But with the Bombay tank, we could carry six. That's still a big bomb load, almost as much as a B-17 carries, or as much. And so we flew to Christmas Eve, 1942. At midnight sharp, we flew over Wake Island. And the idea now was the dive bomb. That's why we had been training with the 59-cent sight. We were to come in at 7,500 feet and pull out at 5,000 feet and drop our bombs. But the island was powdered over. And so we dove down and we had to pull out at 3,500 feet to get under the cloud. In the meantime, the Japanese turned on their searchlights and hit the white clouds from underneath, and the light reflected down. It was just like broad daylight. You could see the Japanese running out of the barracks in their fundoshis, and that's little shorts. And it made it easy to hit the targets. And I had an alternate bomb that I dropped. I saw a Japanese plane taking off from the runway, and I tried to hit him, which was foolish. I knew I couldn't hit him. But the bomb landed behind him and put a hole in the runway, so he might have had a little trouble getting back down. So that was our first mission. Now, the problem was on this mission, we couldn't close our bomb bay doors because we had used our wing tank gas first. When we dove with these full tanks and pulled up, the straps on the tank stretched and the bomb bay doors dropped several inches to the point where the bomb bay doors wouldn't close. And so on the way back to Midway, in the dark of night, we burned up a lot of fuel. And I can remember one of our motors conking out before we got to our bunker. And others had the same problem. But that was our first mission. Now we're veterans, you see. And back to Hawaii, and then they sent us down to a little coral reef called Canton. You can't see anything because everything's covered with coral, even the Quonset hut, the officers' club. And there's where they had a squadron of air cobras, the P-39. And we were to photograph and bomb the Marshall and Gilbert, just three planes. And the commander was on this flight with us. And we flew over the Marshalls and bombed, and then we were to bomb Tarawa. We got to Tarawa, and there was coverage over the island. We couldn't see a thing. And finally, I saw those native toilets. You know how they build a bridge out over the water about maybe 40 or 50 yards out into the lagoon. There were about six of them. And we can't return with our bombs. They won't let you land with the bombs in the plane. So that was my target, was the outhouses. Now, that's not the way to get the Distinguished Flying Cross, believe me. When that was related to the guys back at the base, it didn't set too well. But we had to get rid of the bombs. So we did it that way, and then our next mission was, and our mission in the South Pacific were thousands of miles. I mean, in Europe, you know, 100 miles, 200 miles, 500 miles, but we had to fly down to near New Zealand, to the Ellis Islands, to a small island called Funafuti, a quarter mile wide, a mile long. The island was the runway, and there we had to load up with bombs and then try to fool the Japanese on Nauru. Now, Nauru was a famous island, probably the most concentration of phosphate in the world, the island of Nauru. And the Japanese had it well fortified. They had seven zeros there and a lot of ak-ak. And we were to fool them by flying towards Guadalcanal and coming in on the Guadalcanal heading so they would think the bombers came from there. So we got over our target, and I had my five bombs and one alternate. And my alternate bomb I dropped at the end of the runway on a small shack. I had no idea what it was, but it happened to be the pump house for the underground fuel dump. And so there's a great huge cloud in the sky. It was in all the magazine, Life magazine, a picture of that. And I don't know if it was because of that or what, but three Japanese zeros jumped us. There's other planes there, but they jumped us. And I'm in the nose. I'm through with my job, so I turn the ship back over to the pilot. The navigator's job is now in the nose turret. And I'm looking out the window to look at the zeros, and I hear a crack in front of my face. And a shell, I don't know what it was, 50 caliber or a cannon shell that didn't go off, but it severed the main cable of the nose turret. And the turret was already turned 45 degrees, and there's no way to get out of there now. The door is back behind the frame. So the navigator is stuck in the nose. And then I hear guys hollering for help in the rear of the plane, so I hurried back. I got to the bomb bay. The doors were not closed because our hydraulic system was shot out. And here is the radio man hanging straight down over 10,000 feet of water. And that's when I was glad that I was in the gym every day doing my weightlifting on the base. And I was able to wrestle him back up into the ship and struggle him up onto the radio deck. He was the radio man. He had his sheepskin on, so I couldn't see where he was hit, but he was actually hit with shrapnel through the back. And then I heard other calls for help on the intercom, so I gave him oxygen and laid him back in the corner. And as I was doing so, a bomb hit the radio shack right where his head would have been if he were sitting there. And I heard the crack and all the splatter, and then I felt something trickling down my neck. And I looked up, and that blast had torn the toes off of the left foot of the upper turret man. And so in the meantime, he kept on firing. He didn't stop firing because his toes were shot off. The plane turned around, made another pass, and he got that plane. And I confirmed that as he hit the ground, the beach. And so I took his shoe off, gave him his morphine, patched him up, and then headed where the real trouble was, to the waste window. Now, in the meantime, we had been hit with five cannon fire. Our right tail was shot off. The pilot and co-pilot took two of them to control the plane. They had both hands on the yoke and both knees. For some reason, the plane wanted to climb and stall out. And when I got back to the waist and saw these three guys badly wounded, bleeding, and even parts of their stomachs hanging out, and still firing their machine guns, I called the pilots. I got to have help. I can't handle this alone. So finally, the co-pilot came back, and the two of us, we spent 2 or 3 hours patching these guys up and ministering to them. And I found the wires of the right tail severed with a bomb hole through the base section. That's what got these fellas. And so I'm afraid now if the other side gets hit, we don't have any tail control. So I, being an old sailor, I spliced the wires together best I could to the point where they would be some slack, but at least we get some control. Now the plane is soaked inside with purple oil, which is your hydraulic fluid. We cannot get the wheels down. We cannot get the flaps down. And we're approaching Funafuti. We call the field. We're coming in on a crash landing. And in the meantime, I was able to crank the wheels down. You have to crank the wheels down first so you can see if it's locked. And then you crank the flaps down next. If you crank the flaps down first, you can't see if the wheels lock. So the wheels come down first, then the flaps. And then I took two parachutes, both waist guns on the tripod, and I tied those two parachutes together. Then I put a parachute at the tail gunner's opening. Then I pulled a parachute cord this way, and I had all three rings where I wanted them. If the plane veered to the right, I'd pull the other chute, or vice versa. The runway's only less than a mile long with no brakes now. With hydraulic fluid gone, we're going to go off the end of the runway. So I got my rear chute here. And then I have the fellows tied with a parachute cord. Now, I didn't tie them in because if the plane happened to catch on fire, they'd be in trouble. I had them hold a looper rope around and loop it once and just hold it. And there's a lot of strength in that. And if anything happens, you just let go of that and you're loose. And fortunately, the bullet that went by my face and the nose lodged into the nacelle of the plane and was in the left tire. So when we hit the ground, we didn't need the brakes because we ground looped off of the runway because other planes were coming in bad shape. And so that was the worst raid that I was on and the biggest mess I'd ever seen. Every enlisted man on the plane was badly injured. One died that night, and the co-pilot and I were given credit with having saved two lives out of the rest of them. And I think it's only because Cooper Nell, the co-pilot, by the way, he was the co-winner of the Pulitzer Prize before the war. He and I both had taken advanced first aid in Hawaii. And that's so important to be prepared for survival in every which way you can be prepared. The next mission we went on was simply a search mission. We lost our plane. It was beyond repair. Besides the five cannon holes, it had, I think, nearly 600 bullet and shrapnel holes in the plane. They took a picture from inside with the windows closed, and it looked like the sky at night. That's what's in the papers. So we had to borrow a plane. We came back from the mission. The base was empty. Everybody's in town. And they got a call that a B-25 had gone down 200 miles north of the island of Palmyra, which is about 1,000 miles south of Hawaii. And so we just landed. We were the only crew on the base. And they said, hey, you're the only crew here. How about going down and searching for that plane? Well, we wanted our time off, but we thought, well, we found a B-25 about 6 months before, and we had good luck. So we volunteered. So we took a plane that was never flown in combat because it couldn't get off the ground with a bomb load. It was a lemon. It was called the Green Hornet. We used it for the cabbage run. I was flying to Hilo to pick up steaks and lettuce and cabbage and stuff for the kitchen. That was the only plane available. So we took that. We got in the general vicinity where the B-25 had last reported. We began to circle. Cloud level is 1,000 feet, so we're flying 800 to be able to get a good view. And the RPMs dropped on one motor. And the engineer feathered that. The RPMs dropped on another motor. Now, I know the B-29 can fly, as I was told, about 1,500 miles on two motors by a B-29 pilot here. But a B-24, even the good ones, couldn't fly on two motors very well. And this one could hardly fly on four motors, so we dropped like a rock. We hit the water, plane exploded. And the pilot and the tail gunner were fortunately blown free of the wreckage. I was trapped. Now, my job was to stand at the waist window with a life raft in front of me in a container. I put it in front of me to protect myself, held onto it tight. I ended up under the tripod of the machine gun mount, wedged in so tight I couldn't break loose. I tried. As good a shape as I was in, I couldn't budge. Wires severed from the tail, those spring-like control wires were tangled around both the tripod and myself. And then I began to sink with that waist section. And my ears popped. It got darker. Then I felt like someone hit me in the head with a sledgehammer. Then I lost consciousness. And so you figure, well, it's the pressure of the water that's doing this. Well, as I was still sinking to further depth, I regained consciousness and found myself loosened from that section of the ship and now floating upwards. I really thought I was dead, and I thought, well, this must be the afterlife. Well, I was grateful that I was floating upwards. In the underwater confusion, my arms were all over the place trying to find something. And as I was in the B-24 today, I saw the exact spot on that window where my ring, my USC Trojan ring right there, the white scar still there, twisted over, cut into the bone of my finger. That was the waste window, and I knew that. So I got my other hand down and just struggled to get myself out of that window. As the plane was sinking and the buoyancy of my body, that was a struggle. And I pulled the cords on my life jacket, and fortunately my life jacket inflated. Now, this may sound funny to you, but life jackets don't inflate in the Pacific. The reason why is because they have these CO2 cartridges. They and the, most of the guys overseas had these Shasta bottles for their scotch and soda, and they'd take those cartridges out. And so rarely did we find a vest that had a cartridge in it. We'd have to blow it up by mouth, but this one had the cartridges in it. Popped to the surface, and there, much to my surprise, I see the pilot and tail gunner hanging onto a gas tank. They're both just hanging on, staring straight ahead in a severe state of shock. There's a life raft drifting away from the wreckage area, so I swam, got in the life raft, rode to my buddies, pulled them in, and we began our 47-day drift in the South Pacific. My very first thought as I settled back in the raft was, you know, how in the world did I ever get loose from that situation? I used all the logic I could use, and I could come to no logical explanation. And so it was the first time in my life I ever became aware of some kind of divine intervention. That's all I could think about, and I began to pray. Now, you know what people do in a foxhole. They do it twice as much on a life raft. And the pilot and tail gunner saw me praying. They prayed. Their lives were spared. The pilot's head was severely gashed. I had to take three T-shirts and make a heavy compress, tie it on his head. And we started our unknown to us 47-day drift. We had searched for Rickenbacker, and we spent 2 weeks out there in the ocean looking for Rickenbacker, and we thought, nobody can live beyond 2 weeks. And they picked him up, or he landed on an island in 21 days, and they went to another island, and they finally found him on the 27th day. If we'd have known that we were to be out there 47 days, we probably would have given up at the beginning. Now, our menu was what birds, fish, and water we could catch, and of course the birds and the fish we simply ate raw. We were able to catch 2 small 4-foot sharks, and so on 2 different occasions we had a dinner of raw liver, because shark meat is not edible if it's raw. You can cook it and eat it, but if raw it makes you sick, and we were taught that in survival school, so we simply ate the livers, and we knew that at that time all of our vitamin pills were made from shark liver. The tail gunner was in real bad shape the day of the crash. This is a fellow that was a heavy smoker and drinker, refused to take part in our physical fitness program at the air base. He was always in Honolulu. The first day of the crash, within an hour, he panicked and said, "We're all going to die, we're going to die." And that's ridiculous, because I was an Eagle Scout, and I had taken a survival course in Hawaii, and that's all I could think about, was to put this knowledge into action. And so I had to lay it on him a couple of times, slap him across the face to bring him to his senses, I should say. But he was that way every day, defeated from the beginning. We kept him alive as long as we could. But finally, on the 33rd day, he died during the night, and we buried him at sea. Then we heard motors. We looked up and we saw this small speck in the sky, so we decided on 2 parachute flares and 1 packet of water dye. But the plane just kept on going. It was too far up and off course to do any good. We had those small mirrors. We were flickering, you know. And then all of a sudden, the plane reappeared. They had seen something. They came back, and we recognized it as a B-25. So, of course, we were waving our shirts and screaming, and tears were coming down our eyes to think that rescue was at hand. And when the plane made its first pass, we heard machine gun firing. Of course, water splashed up all around us simultaneously. And I looked up and I saw it looked like a B-25. It was a Japanese Sally bomber, and I saw the red circle. And of course, that was the rising sun. And they came around for another pass, and there were 2 sharks in the water. So we all 3 dove in the water. We preferred the sharks to the machine gun. But when they made their pass, the tail gunner and the pilot just couldn't get back in the raft. And so I had to boost them back in, so they stayed in the raft. And after that, I stayed in the water. I would get out of the water. They made their circle, came back for another run. Then I'd go back in the water with the sharks. And I get in the water with these sharks, and there's a heavy current. My body is just flat, parallel with the water surface. And I can remember my socks were half off and toes were dangling in the water. But I wasn't too worried because I took a course on how to avoid sharks underwater. I took that course in Honolulu. The first thing I was taught was to open my eyes wide and show my teeth because the sharks were afraid of white. So that was my first approach. I opened my eyes and I showed my teeth, but that didn't seem to work. So the second thing that we were taught was that you make a violent motion and the shark will take off. So I tried that, and that didn't work. The third thing we were taught, and the last resort, was a football straight arm. And believe me, that worked. The shark came up slowly, and then when they started to make their pass, you just reach out and you hit their snoot, because their mouth is back about that far from their nose. And when you touch their snoot, they take off that way frightened, and of course you take off this way frightened. And that went on for about, I'd say, 40, 45 minutes in and out of the water with those two sharks. And I couldn't get back in the raft after the pass of the bomber if the shark hadn't made their pass. And then they'd nip me on the leg. And so I had to stay in the water, hold my breath until they made their pass, and then they'd make a circle and I'd pull up into the raft. So the Japanese strafed us for about 45 minutes. And not satisfied with that, they, even though we pretended to be dead, they came around on one last pass. And this time, they, instead of coming off course, they came on course. I saw the bomb bay door open, and they dropped the depth charge on us. And this bomb missed us about 50 feet. And being a bombardier, I know you have to arm a bomb before it'll go off. And evidently, in their excitement up there, they forgot to arm the depth charge. It sank. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting. It never did go off. And I think they gave us up as dead, went back to their air base, and that was it. And we were in pretty sad trouble. I mean, the raft was completely wrinkled up. It was hit every time the plane passed over. I was underneath the raft every time they passed over. I could see the bullets coming through the bottom, furrowing through the water, stopping about 3 feet below the surface. So when you got a hole in the top of the tube, you got one on the bottom. So we got the patching gear out of the raft. It had the dope like you use on your bicycle tires. You have the patch, and then you have a piece of sandpaper, right? Well, that's what they put in the raft. They put in real, genuine sandpaper. And you men know what happens to sandpaper when it gets wet. There was no sand. The sand was on the bottom of the container, and the paper was blank. So there was no way to rough up the rubber and make the patch stick. So I took one of the mirrors and I cut teeth in the edge of the mirror. For the main reason was to open the sharks up. We had no knife. And so I made three teeth on the edge of the metal mirror, and that's how we opened the shark up. And that still took about 20 minutes. They're tough. So now I had to use that to kind of scratch the rubber. We patched the top of the raft, and now we have to patch the bottom. We had to wait for a calm day. We pumped the raft. We take turns. We had to pump it every 15 minutes to keep it afloat. It was always wrinkled. So now we had to let the air out of half of the raft on a calm day and sit on the inflated part of the raft and pull up this end of the raft. And that's a little difficult when you got sharks on the other end of the raft. And we got the patch, the dope on, and as it begins to dry, a little lap of water hits it, and you got to start all over again. It took 8 days of misery to keep that raft afloat. And the raft began to fall apart. Where we ripped the canvas to patch the rubber, it began to rip more and more. The rubber was now getting melted, you know, like burnt rubber. And I think we would have outlasted the raft. But our biggest problem was water. Now, we'd caught three goonie birds, albatross. We caught, I think, three small birds. We caught four or five small fish and those two sharks. Now, of course, the first two goonie birds, we couldn't stand the smell. We just threw them away. We didn't try to eat them. The third one we caught, we were so hungry, it was like, you know, eating a hot fudge sundae with nuts on top of it. But the greatest problem was water. Now, in one stretch, we had to go 7 days without water. And we knew that this was going to kill us. There were squalls out there, here and there, and we tried to row to these squalls because we could see the squall rain. They rained for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And we continually tried to row until we were totally exhausted. And we came to the conclusion that we were killing ourselves, and so we decided not to waste our energy anymore, but to start praying again like we started. And so we just prayed for water. And all of a sudden, well, you want to know how we survived 7 days without water? After about the fourth day, we took turns hanging in the water. One fellow would stay there with the aluminum oar and keep the shark away, or sharks, whatever it was. And the other person would hang in the water for a half hour at a time up to his neck. And at least we knew that would keep the body from dehydrating. And I also heard from a doctor that if you get poison on your skin, you can absorb it. And I thought, well, maybe you can absorb water. 7 days, and we were in bad shape. And then a squall came over right on course. It rained right on range, and we caught enough water to drink. And a coincidence. But we kept on praying for more water, and a couple of days later, another squall came over, right on course, right on range. And we questioned this. I said, you think our prayers are being answered? we weren't convinced. But the third time it happened, we were convinced. And from that time on, we had enough water to survive the 47-day ordeal. And after, on the 47th day, after an all-night storm, we were lifted high on a wave, and I saw land, a beautiful, lush, green island. And the seas were rough, and we were lifted pretty high, and we thought, well, that's a Japanese island. We got to be careful. We got to kind of hold off and try to get in at nighttime. But the winds and the storm drove us hard toward the island and then more islands. And I think we counted like 16 islands, small islands, but we got close enough to see that they had deserted native huts, banana trees and coconut trees. But no people. The natives had been taken by the Japanese to the northern islands for labor. So we were determined to make one of the islands and set up housekeeping. But before we could land on any island, a Japanese patrol boat happened to be in the area that day. They happened to see us, above us. I think there were three or four Japanese zeros up there dogfighting, practicing. Now, they might have spotted us and turned the report in. We don't know, but the patrol boat picked us up, and they looked at the raft. They couldn't believe it, full of holes. They couldn't talk any English, but before they picked us up, as the boat passed us, this Navy vessel passed us, every man aboard had a gun aimed at us and a machine gun, and they had their swords pulled. And here we were, helpless in this raft. And then they slowed down and they opened up their shirts and went like that and motioned for us to do that. And I thought, they're going to shoot us in the chest, you know. So we opened up our shirts and closed our eyes, and there was no shots fired. Then I suddenly realized they probably wanted to know if we had a weapon. So we were drug aboard this ship and from here taken to, I believe it was the island of Woji, blindfolded, thrown into a cells there, weighed in a little under 30 kilos, and I heard my first Japanese word, Ohio. The treatment there wasn't bad. Of course, we were, you know, a couple of piles of bone, having lost 100 pounds apiece. We couldn't walk. We couldn't stand up. We could crawl. That's about it. Then they said, tomorrow morning you will be put aboard a ship and be taken to Kawajima. And after you leave here, we cannot guarantee your life. Well, that was comforting. We get aboard the ship, and the skipper is a merchant ship, been into Seattle many times, came out to talk to us. And we got to Kwajalein, again blindfolded, and here treated rough. These guys were rough. thrown into fells 2 feet, 3 inches wide, 7 feet deep, 6 feet long, are home now for the next 43 days in solitary confinement. The guards, one guard told us that all prisoners are executed here. They cut their heads off. And we thought he was just, you know, trying to scare us. And then a native from the island, who was a fanatic Trojan follower, they allowed him to come in and talk to me. He knew every football player by name, when SC won, when they lost. And boy, we talked for about an hour. And then he says, well, Louis, unfortunately, they execute all prisoners taken on Kwajalein. And I looked on the wall of my cell, and there was 9 names engraved. And on top, there was a caption that said, 9 Marines marooned on Macon Island, August the 12th, 1942. Well, I remember that date. I remember the Doolittle raid over Tokyo. And the next greatest thing, a morale booster, was when 4 American submarines approached the island of Macon. That's the northmost, I guess, of the Gilbert Islands. And there in a midnight surprise attack, this is, by the way, James Roosevelt was on that raid. These guys were led ashore in life rafts, these Marines, and evidently killed every Japanese on that island by surprise. But evidently, these 9 Marines were confused with direction or timing. They just didn't show up at the departure point on the beach at the proper time. They were left there marooned until the Japanese came back to the island, took them prisoners. They were in these cells where we were in, but they were all 9 killed by decapitation. And even following our departure, another B-24 crew was captured, taken to the same island, Kwajalein, and executed in the same manner. So we felt really fortunate to be allowed to go on to Japan as prisoners of war. Now, I was confused by all this, why our lives were spared. The guards were somewhat mystified. But many years later, I found out why our lives were spared, which I'll go into. We're on a ship now headed for trucks. After a week in trucks off to Yokohama, on the way to Yokohama, a big submarine scare. The whole ship was in a panic, and I was up in some officer's room, locked in. And naturally, being up there alone, I was going through things, you know. And I found a hidden, great big bottle of sake, you know. And so I thought, well, they won't miss one little nip. Well, one little nip every day for 3 weeks, the bottle didn't look very good, you know, and I'm sure that when we got off the ship in Yokohama that whoever had that, that was a, he had to be a high-ranking officer. It was a good cabin. But the submarine scare evidently was false, or the submarine left, whatever it was, and that was a little frightening to think the ship would go down at sea and we'd be on it. Yokohama, came in there at nighttime. An officer came in a Chevrolet sedan. I remember looking through my blinds at the bottom. I saw the Chevrolet hubcap. And they shoved me in the jump seat. In my long legs, I just couldn't get my legs up there right. And he got mad and cracked me across the face, broke my nose with the flashlight. And so I thought, well, things are getting rougher. It took us to a secret camp called Ofana. And this is just up from Yokohama. Yeah, that's probably the movie capital of Japan now. That's where all the movies are made. And so here we are in this little dinky camp, unregistered prisoners of war. In the meantime, I'm declared dead because the Japanese have not registered me. We were seen at sea when we crashed. The plane blew up, and a general signed the report that there were no survivors. And so that made it official. What could happen to these guys who crash in friendly waters and they've been missing for that length of time? They got to be dead. And they had no idea we drifted across the Pacific 2,000 miles. So the officer said, okay, you go into this room and just bow your head and stand up and wait for further orders. So I went in there and I bowed my head and stood up. And this fellow sitting at the desk had his head down. He looked up at me. And there he was. He says, you know who I am. I says, you bet I do. James Vasaki, USC 36-40. He was sent over here from Japan. He went to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and USC in 10 years. And he had no accent, a master of the English language, and slang. He knew every word of slang, so you couldn't double talk around the guys. And yeah, I said, I know you as well as I do my own brother. And so he, when he was at SC, his job was to go into the Japanese communities, Gardena and Torrance, in that area, and speak to the Nisi, the second generation. The Ishii is the first generation. He was there to speak to the first generation that were born in Japan to keep them faithful to the homeland. And I can recall as working for the Japanese farmers in Torrance that they were, in those days, all your cigarettes and your gum was wrapped in lead foil. You know, we should all be dead now. Lead, we used to chew that stuff. And they say lead's bad for you, but we lived on lead foil. And they would save a ball of that and ship it to Japan. They'd ship brass and copper. So we saw that firsthand from Torrance and Gardena and Lomita, which was a Japanese farming community. And that was his job. I found out from him in prison camp. He said, well, yes, I lectured to the Japanese to keep them faithful to the homeland, so they knew something was coming up. So I saw him like once a month. When there was a complaint in the camp, the guys would say, Louie, you know, the head guy, you know, you tell him what they're doing to us. And I'd tell him, and oh, he was so sweet and nice. And when he'd leave camp, I'd get the heck beat out of me. So I just had to learn to keep my mouth shut. And then after there about 6 months, now this is a camp of solitary confinement, 14 months I was there. And about, I'd say, 7 months after there, or 8 months, I guess it was, yeah, in comes Pappy Boyington, and shrapnel in his leg. They put him right next to me, unfortunately. This guy was a real character and caused a lot of trouble. He just didn't like to take orders or obey rules, and so at times it was funny, and at times it was we were sorry he was there. You don't obey the Japanese rules. Or see, the Japanese, you mentioned international law, and when you said international, by the time you got to the L, you were hit over the head. There's no such thing as international law, Japanese law only. So you couldn't use that old escape, you know. Officers don't have to work according to international law. That didn't go with the Japanese very well, so we were beaten up more than once for using that phrase. After a while, I was transferred to headquarters Camp Omori, and that's where I met the bird. This guy was so rotten. We had dirty names for all the guards, but this guy was so bad they couldn't think of a word bad enough for him, so they just called him the bird. And I'm lined up, new in the camp, and he's walking by, and I looked at him with my eyeballs as he went by, and he turned around and slugged me, knocked me down, and what did I do? You know, I looked at him, eyes straight ahead. And every day for 10 days I got beaten up. So I had a chance to talk to his assistant. Now, he was a disciplinary officer, and a guy named Kono was his assistant. Well, what happened was the newspaper came up to the first camp with a file. They have a file on every athlete in America. He came up there with all these pictures of my races, and the guy came up and interviewed me for the Asahi Shimbun, the world's largest newspaper at that time. And I guess they got in the Japanese press, and but so this assistant to the head guy said, he's not going to get special treatment here, thinking because I had been an Olympic athlete that I'd get special treatment. And so I got beaten up every day for 10 days. And this guy, I tell you, I got to the point where I couldn't stand him. His eyes, he'd look at me, he'd talk real sweet, and then take off this great big web belt about that wide and about a half inch thick with a big brass buckle. Great, huge thing. He'd take it off and welch you across the head with the buckle. And so I was always trying to avoid this fellow, you know. But he always sought me out and I always got my punishment. So finally, finally Radio Tokyo came in and they said, we want you to come in and make a broadcast. I thought, oh, finally I get to send news home to my parents. So they took me into Tokyo in the wintertime. And I know it was winter because they don't give you coats in the winter. So, but when I went into Tokyo, they gave me a great big, beautiful, heavy army coat to wear. And when you come back to the freezing camp with a foot of snow outside, they take the coat away from you. And they put it in a storehouse, so they want it to be cold all the time. So I go into Tokyo, and they allow me to make a broadcast with my own words. Of course, there was so much static in it, nobody really recognized it at home. 2 weeks later, they came back to the camp and said, "Oh, you got a beautiful radio voice. We want you to come back and make another broadcast." Well, this was a scheme they'd worked out in advance. So I go to Radio Tokyo, and they show me this propaganda they'd written up, wanted me to read it. And I said, "Well, that doesn't sound like me." And I said, "Nobody would believe it back home." And I said, "I can't read that." And they had about five or six copies on the desk, and I had my big coat on with the slit pockets inside. And when they were out in the other room discussing my fate, I reached in and I grabbed a copy of the propaganda, which I brought home. I got it home and gave it to the war crimes trial. And they came out and says, "If you don't read this on Radio Tokyo, you will go to punishment camp." And then they said, "We want you to have lunch." They took me into this beautiful cafeteria, as good as anything in America, in the Radio Tokyo. Wonderful lunch. Well, what we were eating was really, we were lucky if we got fish heads and barley. I mean, barley or millet and seaweed. We had to pull the seaweed out of the ocean, boil it, and then chew it up. It was like rubber. And that was our diet three times a day. And to eat in a restaurant now, man, this was something else. I just, tears came to my eyes. Then they took me into a room, and they showed me a room like a hotel room, white sheets, and here we were sleeping on planks with nothing, and the plank cracks were lined with insects from end to end. And so you woke up in the morning, your entire body was just a welt of bites. That's the way you were every day. And then they brought out an American and two Australians who were making broadcasts. And they thought that would impress me. And when I went up to shake their hands, they both looked down at the floor. And I said, no way I'm going to make that broadcast. And so I went back to my prison camp at Omori. I thought, well, I'd rather face the bird every day than to humiliate my country like these fellows. And they knew they had because they could not look me in the eye. A week later, the bird's transferred. Now, in the meantime, I'm supposed to be transferred. Now I want to stay, you see. I'm there with the Royal Scots. There are about 16 Royal Scots. They were in prison in Scotland, and the Queen gave them a choice. Serve the Queen or stay in jail. So they served the Queen, went to Hong Kong, were captured. And they were a great bunch because they were such good crooks. They stole the Japanese blind. They were stealing smoked oysters in cans when they loaded the ship. They'd steal sugar. They'd steal tobacco. And we watched the Japanese. They knew they were stealing. They'd search them every day, and they couldn't find a thing. They took the tobacco leaves, and they'd wet them and wrap them around their calves, and then they'd take those World War I leggings the Japanese used and wrap those around. And when they went to get their shoes to go to work, they'd always get two sizes too large. And the Japanese couldn't understand it. You know, the Americans got big feet, and they order bigger shoes. Well, they'd fill their socks with sugar halfway and then lay it in the bottom of their shoes, and then they'd put their feet over that and buckle up and walk into prison camp with sugar. So I had my first taste of sugar in like 2 years, and it just drove me out of my mind. But the Royal Scots were really a generous group. They did all the stealing and gave us these little treats that we got. So anyway, with the bird gone now, I wanted to stay there, but there was no way because they promised me I'd go to a labor camp, a punishment camp. And so a week after the bird left, I was put aboard a train up into the northern Honshu, up into what they call their Alps country, snow-capped peaks, and got out of the train, and there must have been 12 or 15 feet of snow on the ground because all the houses were covered. And we marched into this prison camp right on the corner of two rivers coming together at the ocean. We were told to stand at attention in the compound, and the honcho shack was across from us. And the door opened, and out stepped the bird. And I had heard about people who were so frightened that their knees buckled. My knees buckled. I never thought it would happen to me, but my knees buckled. I almost went to the ground. And I knew they had set this all up and did it on purpose because I wouldn't make that lousy broadcast. So now I'm back with the bird again, and boy, I'll tell you, I really felt bad about that, really. And I knew he was going to be after me again, and sure enough, labor, heavy labor every day, either pulling the human excretion. We had to save that. We called them honey dippers. We had to put it in kegs, weighed hundreds and hundreds of pounds, and they put harnesses on us like a horse, and we had to tow that 7 miles to a farm and put it on the garden. And when we got the garden going, then the ships pulled into the harbor, big, I'd say, 10,000-ton coal ships. That we were. These are the officers. The enlisted men didn't have to do this. The officers were here. This was the punishment camp for officers. We had to get down on the hold of the ship and shovel like 10 to 14 hours a day, fill these nets, load the barges. Barges are taken up the river then, and the ship left. We go up to the barges with a wicker basket on your back. It holds about 100 pounds of coal, maybe 150. And one fellow loads that, and you have to walk up to a half car and unload it there. And this went on till the end of the war. This was Camp 4B in a city called Noetsu. And the camp was made up mainly of Americans and Australians and New Zealanders. And when Niigata was raided, we always heard the planes go over at night, and it thrilled our hearts to know that they were bombing Niigata, even though we knew that we would be called out of bed and punished downstairs for the bombing raid. And I remember a handful of the Englishmen. The Englishmen were pretty good people, so the Australians were great and the New Zealanders were great. But there were a handful of English people there that complained to the Japanese, "Those are American planes. Why punish us?" You know. This camp was a brutal camp of not just punishment, but this heavy, torturous labor. And I got injured on the job, couldn't work, and so they cut my ration in half. If you don't work, you get half rations. And I had to figure out a way to get some work. So I saw a room where they had a white sewing machine. Now, you women know what that is. There's a Singer in white in the old days. And I had been weaned on a white sewing machine since I was 5 years old. I used to sew all the time. So I told the guard, "You tell the head honcho that I'm a tailor." And so they came running to me, all the guards. They wanted their clothes cut like Hollywood, you know, their coats taken in here. And so I did that. And I did it for one guy, and he went out, and they all came in. They all wanted their clothes tailored and cut down. So when I finished doing that, there was no more work. And I wanted to stay on full rations, so I told him I was a barber. Well, when I was a kid, I said, "Hey, go get a quarter from your mother for a haircut, and I'll cut your hair, and we'll go to the movie." Well, when I first started, it was the mothers complained about the haircut. I got pretty good after a while, and that's how we made our money as kids. So I cut Japanese hair. Then they wanted me to shave them. I'd never used a straight razor in my life, and I was scared stiff. But they wanted me to shave their foreheads and trim their eyebrows. And so there's one guard I couldn't stand. He just made me sick to my stomach, and he wanted me to shave his eyebrows. So I shaved his eyebrows real thin. And he went over and looked in the mirror, and you know what he said? "Marlene Dietrich." So he had promised me a rice ball, but he wouldn't give it to me because I made him look like a woman. So that, anyway, so finally, we kept hearing rumors, the war's over, war's over, so we don't believe rumors anymore. The Japanese came to us one day and said, "Oh, a bad thing has happened in a city called Hiroshima. Everybody's got cholera. The city is dying from cholera. Nobody's allowed in, nobody's allowed out. We can't call there." And we thought, well, that's pretty bad, you know. Then, finally, we were told to paint POW on the roof. Well, that was the first time we heard a rumor the war was over, and then we were told to paint POW. Then, next day, a Japanese plane came over, and evidently with an American observer in it, and spotted the camp and left. And then we were told for the first time that we were allowed to swim in the river, a muddy river, but we were allowed to swim. In the meantime, the bird got so rotten And it was so rough on us, we decided to take a 75-pound to 80-pound rock up on the second floor of our barracks, which was straight down to the river. There was a cement wall, and then the building was built straight up. And we were going to get him when the war ended, take him up there, tie him to that rock, and throw him out the window. It was all planned. We had the rock there ready to go. We had the rope hidden. And so finally, a TBF came over. And, of course, we recognized it. And the red dash on the side did it, did it, did it. And a radio man in the water, hey, he says the war's over. So the bird knew it the day before because he disappeared. And we never saw him again. And so we got out of the water, got dressed. The TBF came back about 2 or 3 hours later, and we saw a body dropping from the plane. Hit the compound, and it was a pair of Navy pants tied. You know, they have a string here, and they tied the bottoms. And the first plane that came over, when we came out, they circled the camp 2 or 3 times and then dropped a red ribbon. And on the end of the red ribbon was a pack of cigarettes with 2 cigarettes missing and a chocolate bar with 1 bite out of it. We had to divide the chocolate among 300 prisoners. So we each got a sliver. It worked out. I mean, we all got a little sliver of chocolate to taste. And then they formed circles, and each circle got a cigarette. And you had to take one puff and go around the circle. He came back, and in the past now he had a couple of cartons of cigarettes, cartons of candy, and a magazine with the atomic bomb on the cover. And that, we never even heard about a B-29, let alone the atomic bomb. Here we are just dead still looking at that, and we couldn't figure out what was happening. Then we tied it all in with the cholera at Hiroshima. The Japanese public was told that the disease cholera broke out and the city was quarantined. They didn't dare tell them that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima, or the public probably would have revolted. So we tied that in. Then that was not food, of course. That was cigarettes and candy. But we were grateful for that, and we were just thrilled and elated the war's over. And then I became duty officer. And I went outside and with lime, and I put a sign, drop here, and an arrow to the rice paddies, because if you drop food in the prison camp with a parachute, even with a parachute, canned goods or anything like that would kill a man on the ground. So I'm outside waiting for this drop of food. I'm in my khaki shirt. I got a red armband. That's the duty officer in Japan. And here comes this B-29. What a sight. We'd seen them over Tokyo. We watched the Tokyo raid, 450 bombers bombing Tokyo. We had a panoramic view of the whole thing. We saw the Japanese zeros being popped out of the sky like little firecrackers up there. We heard the Japanese head guy call the Japanese Air Corps no good when he saw that. Then we saw a big B-29 shot down in a fallen leaf just maybe a mile or two from the camp. 9 guys bailed out. 2 zeros came down from 30,000 feet and strafed those 9 guys all the way to the water just to get out of the battle, I think. And then on another raid, a Navy raid, we saw a zero right over our fence. We were all at the fence like that. And the zero went by, and here come I think it was a Hellcat, and I could see the pilot's face as he went by. The zero went over Tokyo, and the other guy was smart enough to go out over the sea and get away. But here's this beautiful big B-29. I think he made one pass. Then he dropped his food in the rice paddy. Then he came around lower and kind of winged over, and I'm out there waving like mad at him, and he's looking down at me, and I'm looking up at him. And I thought, God, I'd like to meet that guy and that crew, you know. And little did I know that he was up there saying the same thing. Well, after the war, a number of years, I was on a TV show with, I forget who it was, Ted Malone or somebody. And I happened to mention Noetsu. And this pilot of that ship, I think he was 19 years old. He had told his wife and his sister-in-law or someone about Noetsu. And the sister-in-law never forgot that name. And she heard the show, I believe that's the way it was. And she called him he got in touch with Ted Malone. And finally, a few of you got together in Hollywood, meeting for the first time. And I want you to meet Byron Kenny, the pilot of that B-29. Stand up, Byron. Well, he was just a kid, 19 years old, flying a bomber, and he still looks like a kid. And by the way, Byron, there it is. I was asked to donate this to the... I was asked to donate that to the museum for their prisoner of war thing, which I'm glad to do because I have no further use for it. The climax was tonight. Anyway, the war's over. I'm flown home, and the 48 Olympics are coming. I'm still young enough to make the Olympics. There's a lot of publicity in Southern California. The studios opened their doors to me. The nightclubs in Hollywood. It was just a, free show for me. And Warner Brothers actually gave me their boxes at both racetracks where I could go and take my friends, eat and drink, and charge it to the studio. And I got to living a pretty lively life, but I still wanted to make the Olympic team, so I started to train. And I got in pretty good shape, but when I knew I had to now put the pressure on and get into world-class competition shape, and then my war injuries began to surface. I had a calf explosion, and my knee went out, and so I had to quit running and got very depressed and started to drink a lot. And the more I felt sorry for myself, the more I drank. I was married now, had a little girl, and my wife got fed up with it all. And I was out with a couple of my Olympic buddies that liked to do the same thing every night. And finally, she went to Florida to see her mother, came back, and decided that the divorce was the only way. So, and she was entitled to it. And then, in 1949, an unknown person came to Los Angeles and held a Christian meeting in a tent. Unknown at the time, and yet one of the most famous men in the world today, Billy Graham. And my wife was talked into going down to see Billy Graham, to listen to him. And she made a decision that night, came back, and she said her whole life had changed after that meeting, and she didn't want a divorce now. Well, then she tried to get me down during the course of the next week, and of course I fought it and fought it and fought it. And after about 7 days, she finally convinced me through a little trickery. Well, not really trickery. Billy Graham was talking about scientific things in the Bible that coincide with scientific things today. And I was interested in science, so I thought, well, I'll go down. But see, I'd always been poisoned against tent meetings because in the early days of this tent evangelist, it was a sight to see. We used to crawl under the tent and peek inside, and we were told to stay away. And so Billy Graham had three strikes against him before I got there. But as long as I was there, I thought, well, I'll look inside. And I looked inside, and everything seemed okay. So I sat down. I got my next surprise when they introduced Billy Graham. I'd already pictured what he'd look like, and here was this tall, handsome, clean-cut, all-American athletic type. And then I got my next surprise when he began to talk. But he talked only of one person, and that was the person of Jesus Christ. And when he finished preaching and started to give an invitation, I got up and grabbed my wife and pulled her on home. That was time for me to go. But that night I didn't sleep too well. I kept thinking of all the prayers on the raft, all the prayers in prison camp, all the promises, Lord, if you save me through all this, I'll seek you and serve you. I come home to a wild life and forgot the promises. And the next day she was on me again. I said, Cynthia, forget it. I'm not going to go. But my wife is a very persuasive person, maybe a little pushy. finally, I said, okay, I'll go back, but under one condition. When this fellow says, every head bowed and every eye closed, we're getting out. So she said, that's fair enough, just to get me down there. So sure enough, when Billy Graham began to quote the scriptures, for all have sinned, come short of the glory of God, not a righteous man upon earth that doeth good, sinneth not. But the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. And then he started to ask for every head bowed. I grabbed my wife and daughters for the aisle. When I got there, I stopped momentarily, and I couldn't go out. I thought about the promises, and so I went back to the room and where a fellow dealt with me. And I came home that night and took all my liquor, and it was good stuff. My father-in-law was an importer. I can name it. Pomeroy, Grenoble, Mums, Clicquot, all the best. Poured it all down the drain, threw my cigarettes away. And the next morning, I got my little New Testament, went up in the, I mean, World War II. I still have it. The Army New Testament. Went up in Barnesville Park and began to read the gospel. And when I read the accounts of Christ, I began to cry like a baby, and that solidified it right there. And so I dedicated my life to social work, working with problem kids. And today I work with two extreme age groups, the very old and the very young. And I find very little difference, except that the older are just a little slower. And it's been a thrilling life, you know, in this work, in the ministry of serving the Lord. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and my main ministry is skiing. Snow skiing, and I started at 45, and for a man my age, 76, I do stunts, and I'm pretty wild like a kid on skis, and that draws kids. They want to know how old I am, and it gives me a chance to talk to them, and almost every kid on the ski slope's got a problem. It may not seem like a problem to adults, but it's a problem to them, and it gives me a chance to deal with them and to help them and give them some direction and guidance. Now, in 1952, I must say this, that after the war, and this was a serious thing in my life, I had nightmares every night. I mean, every night. I couldn't go to sleep at night without dreaming about the bird. Being Italian, you know, I have to get revenge. And in my dreams, I got revenge. I was always finding this guy, and I was strangling him. And I almost strangled my wife one night, and that scared her. But after my conversion, I've never had a nightmare since. That was 1949. I haven't had the slightest inkling of a nightmare. I never dream at all about the prison life. Any issue in the Pacific at all, I never dream about it. But in 1952, I knew then I had forgiven the Japanese guards, all of them. And I knew that in my heart. Then I often thought about, well, if I saw them face to face and looked into those same eyes, what would I do? What would my reaction be? I know I've forgiven them. So I had the chance of going back in 1952. And there I met Jake DeSager. He was on the Doolittle raid over Tokyo, shot down, captured. And he was thrown a Bible by a Japanese who got the Bible off of Wake Island. And he was converted in his cell and went back to Japan after the war as a missionary. He's been there ever since. So now I'm in Tokyo. I'm with the GHQ chaplain. He said, I'm sorry, but Sugamo Prison is a restricted area. Life magazine's been here for 2 months trying to get in. And then he said, I suggest you call MacArthur's headquarters. And so I called MacArthur's headquarters, and within 2 minutes, MacArthur answered the phone. And, oh, he said, yeah, the reason you should try to talk to MacArthur is he's the one that asked for 10 million Bibles and 2,500 missionaries. That was in the papers. And so he said, okay, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, you'll gain entry to Sugamo Prison. So I went there, and, of course, I got pictures of all this. 850 war criminals. Now we got about, what, 500 seats here? So you can almost double that. And among those people are my guards, overseers of my prison camps. And I didn't let down. I told them the truth about my treatment, how they treated me. And only through my commitment to God could I honestly forgive them. And then I sat down, and then the colonel came up. And he said, well, aren't you going to give them a chance to become Christians? So I said, yeah. So I did, and about 50% raised their hand. I said, well, now this will in no way shorten your sentence. We have nothing to do with the military. And still the same number of hands went up. Okay. So then he said, those of you who knew Louis in prison camp, come up here on the side of the room. And then I saw him. I identified him one by one. And I don't know why I reacted, but I jumped off of the stage, and I ran up, and I gave the first guy a hug, and he pulled away from me. He just couldn't understand it, I guess. In the room, he understood it later on. But I went in the room and everyone made a commitment, except one. That was the quack, what we call the Congojo in the Camp Ofuna. And he's the one that tried to find the shrapnel in Pappy Boynton's leg. He kept cutting him here and then he cut him here. So Pappy was all scarred up till he finally found a piece of shrapnel. But he had gotten life imprisonment for almost killing prisoners of war and stealing food from the prisoners. So anyway, I finished speaking there and I went the next week to the Civic Auditorium to speak to 18,000 Japanese. Raining like mad outside, but the place was jam-packed. And afterward, the little Japanese woman came up to me and she bowed and said, you know, I'm a Christian. She said, the reason your life was spared on the island of Kwajalein was because my son was an officer in authority there, and it was his words that saved your life. So now I finally found out. And then she said, he's a USC Trojan. I couldn't believe it. She said, he's the manager of a department store in Tokyo. So she gave me the address. I went over there, and I got movies of us together and shots of us together. And he told me that he couldn't come forward. See, I'd say four times during 43 days we were interviewed by a panel of officers dressed in pure white. These uniforms were spotless, put on just for this interview, you know, to get information on the radar especially, you know. And he was always in the background. And then he told me why. He said, if I had said that I was a USC Trojan and so forth and tried to help you at the panel, it wouldn't have carried as much weight until we waited till the final session where we made a decision. I made a suggestion, and they accepted it. And so that's why our lives were spared. It's a real thrill to be here tonight, believe me. It's a pleasure, and God bless you all.